listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Well, you probably first heard here the suggestion that a Trump presidency may actually be good for world peace. That suggestion, perhaps crazy idea when first uttered, was brought to us by Professor Tony Montero. However, lately, it seems others are starting to come around, among them Chris Hedges, who in a recent interview with TV Ontario asked, "Are we witnessing the collapse of the American empire?" And more to the point, an article earlier this month at the website truthdig.com, where Gareth Porter asks, "Could Trump take down the American empire?" The latter of those two pieces draws heavily on Bob Woodward's book, Fear, Trump in the White House. For more on that, we decided to speak with Professor Montero via Skype from Philadelphia Thursday. Well, Tony, let's see. It seems the world is beginning to catch up with you. You got Chris Hedges and Gareth Porter both asking questions, basically centering on the piece Gareth Porter had in Truth Dig October 2nd, Could Trump Take Down the American Empire? That's the title of that one. And then we've got Chris Hedges, Are We Witnessing the Collapse of the American Empire? You know, you've been saying from the get-go, really, that Trump appears to represent this entire, you know, I don't know, maybe a pilot for that collapse, if not the architect of it, perhaps sort of a hybrid role in those two things. What do you think, first of all, about... Nobody's mentioned your name in these articles, by the way. And I don't know, are you getting royalty checks or what?
Well, you know, I like to think that, you know, we're all belatedly coming to the same position. Because, you know... liberal progressives like Chris Hedges and Gareth Porter in 2016, and I would imagine most of 2017, were trumpeting the hysterical thing of Trump is a fascist, Trump represents the end of democracy, and all of that type of thing. But I think with Gareth Porter, his article in Truth Dig is an investigation and almost a review of Bob Woodward's book called Fear, the book on the Trump White House. And he has dug into it and saw what was its central core, central concern, and that is Trump's position in foreign policy. And what Woodward shows is what I think you and I have been discussing for over 2 years now, well over 2 years, about 2.5 years to be more accurate, right, is that whether Trump saw what many people, even those among the neoliberals and Democrats, saw, that the American empire was too expensive, and that as a consequence of this military empire and this imperial overreach, the United States would fall behind the Asian economic superpowers, in particular China and India, that the United States could not be both a economic superpower, especially with the Asian giants, and a military empire at the same time. And I think Trump understood this. And if you listen closely, that is precisely what he is saying when he talks about peace on the Korean Peninsula, pull back from NATO, no intervention, and so on. Of course, that's him speaking, and I think that doesn't mean that everybody or most people in his administration are saying the same thing. I mean, with Chris Hedges, of course, he sees a doomsday scenario. And it's quite interesting that for him, the collapse of the American empire is nothing to be celebrated. For us, it is a necessary stage opening up the door to the transition to a world democratic system, an international democratic system, both politically and economically, among nations, but also a necessary stage if there is to be genuine people's democracy in this country and what I would hope for, a socialist redoing of the economy. The American empire has to be ended. It is not a dark day. It is an inevitable moment, and if we can educate the people, the outcomes of this could be very, very positive and bright, if not in the short run, at least in the medium and long run.
You know, if that process is going to occur, which is inevitable, really.
Yes.
And if the possibility of it occurring is now, well, you have someone at the helm, in terms of being at the helm, I'm talking about Commander-in-Chief specifically of the U.S. military, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. who says, let's not use that because it's expensive and it doesn't really ever do what we want at the end of the day. Isn't that a better condition for us and for everybody else within the sights of those guns than having someone else? In other words, having somebody that says we shouldn't be fighting wars because it's too expensive, as opposed to somebody saying, what do you think we got the military for? We're going to use it whenever we want.
Absolutely. In other words, to put it another way, was the outcome of the 2016 election a good outcome given the opposition to Trump was Hillary Clinton? Right. And you would have to say that that Hillary Clinton would have been a worse president, a war presidency, the opposite of what Trump is. Now, the way the deep state, and I think that's an accurate concept, just like I think the concept military-industrial complex is an accurate description.
For sure.
The majority of the deep state, the vast majority, it would seem, are opposed to Trump, and they're trying to get him out of there and, in a sense, have a redoing of the 2016 election in such a way as to say Trump was an aberration, the normal pattern of the transfer of political power, even if it's from Democrat to Republican or Republican to Democrat, cannot change the strategic position of U.S. imperialism in the world. Trump's victory was, in effect, saying that all of those assumptions and all of those practices that we have become, and I'm being a bit ironic, we have become accustomed to over the last 70 years have to be redone. That is his fundamental instinct. It is his basic worldview in international politics. Now, he's being pilloried. He's being presented as what he is not. I would say that he is a political maneuverer, which he'd have to be. He ran as a Republican, albeit one who attacked every major Republican insider that he ran against. Yep. He literally decimated the Republican establishment in order to win the nomination and then the election.
Right.
It was an extraordinary feat.
That's right.
But he cannot govern without the support of Republicans, given
right.
the ferocity of the Democratic attack upon him.
Right.
And this gets to the Brett Kavanaugh, who is a centrist, who's not a right winger. I don't think is concerned with overturning Roe v. Wade. I don't think it will be overturned. But more important than gender politics or the other issues that are important to certain constituencies, in particular the petty bourgeoisie, that become the center of the base, the real base that they're trying to make for the Democratic Party. Irrespective of all of that, when you look at the question of peace, the question of detente with Russia, the question of peace and demilitarization of the Korean Peninsula, the question of non-intervention. Well, people say, well, what about Iran? Yes, and what about Saudi Arabia? I mean, these are questions on the table. But at the same time, we cannot overlook the overriding question, which is war and peace.
Right.
That along with the question of the climate and climatic warming are the two issues that could end the human species right. as well as other species on this planet. So yeah. if the Trump presidency can bring us closer to a general peace in the world, or as Chris Hedges and Gareth Porter put it, the end of American empire. Could Trump be that presidency? And I think with you and myself, we are betting on the fact that he can be that right. presidency.
Right. Right. And again, it seems like the need for.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, go ahead.
No. And it seems like, as you yes. said, that he sees the need for it as an expense. You know, looking yeah. at the ledger sheet.
Yes. Yes. And so, I mean, but does that solve all the problems? I mean,
no.
You know, I think as we have said, if there is a left that's worth anything, it would support him where it can, albeit critically criticize him and condemn him where we must. Right. I mean, that's politics. Yeah. And in the process, build up the mass base for a politic that goes beyond Trump.
That's
but
right.
At this moment, to join with the neoliberal deep state and others who are committed to fortifying and building up American empire,
right.
We must do the opposite. To march in the Women's March, or to be a part of this Me Too movement at this time, which is really not about women's freedom, because it is not addressing the problems of the working class and poor women, they never have. To join with that against Trump is really to join with the deep state in effect.
Yep. You know, if you wanted to talk about women's rights in the public sphere, and if you wanted to do action after action after action and move towards shutting everything down to make people listen to you, why is it that you would choose a Supreme Court nomination instead of, say, unequal pay? Like today,
you.
Like waking up today and saying, yeah. I'm going to go do that. The reason is because people were organized into it, and they, you know, this is this AstroTurf kind of organizing.
Mm-hmm.
You've got media plugins, whether social, television, whatever, that have data on everyone. They know that, you know, the extent, for example, within an order of magnitude of people being sexually abused in the country that have, you know, anger over it, latent anger, you know, submerged anger, whatever, feelings that can be manipulated. And so those people are being, all of us, I mean, they've got us all like micro, where they can microcast to us. And you see everybody that is able to be moved is moved right now into the public sphere to hate each other rather than the source of oppression. The Fox Channel directs people to hate people on MSNBC. MSNBC is directing them to hate people on Fox. They're all working class people, most of them.
Well, I would suggest that a good part of the working class are not listening to either.
Yep, that's true.
Station. And there was an interesting article, op-ed piece in the Financial Times by Lawrence Summers, former president of Harvard, former economic advisor to Obama, and I guess other presidents. He said that he and his wife drove from Chicago to San Francisco, and they took the back roads, the small highways and stuff, and they saw America that was different than coastal America. And they don't pretty much look at the news. They mainly listen to radio, and they're people who, as communities, deal with their problems. And they make judgments upon what is in their interest, but they're not guided by a lot of what goes on in the mass media. They don't trust it.
Right.
I think polls show over and over again that the majority of American people do not trust the corporate media.
Right.
And certainly if you get to young people, they really don't trust it, nor do they trust the Congress or Wall Street or the banks. I mean, we're in a crisis of legitimacy. And you're right, these invented and manufactured movements and who was behind them. I mean, most of them are these demonstrations are organized by people who are parts of NGOs and that are funded by various sources that have a vested interest, I would say, in the neoliberal global order, and as such, in the U.S. empire, U.S.
Right.
imperialism.
Right.
So I think it's already tainted. It is already a bias in the direction of the old order. I think it was Gareth Porter in his article said that Trump is taking a wrecking ball to the old order and really to the two-party system as we know it. This is not a bad thing.
Right.
And the central question for the American people are centered at the level of the class struggle, the class issues of jobs, of wages that have not risen over the last decade. Again, I'm always referring to Philadelphia. A study came out recently that showed that while poverty, at least officially, was declining in most of the country in 2016 and 2017, it rose in Philadelphia. And Philadelphia is the third major city in the country in terms of inequality. It is a grotesque thing to see up close. And I see it up close because I live here. This shining downtown and these growing and expanding and gentrifying universities, but yet the majority of people are growing poorer.
Right.
And deep poverty, and children are hungrier. So I say that to say that the Me Too movement is a diversion from the fundamental questions of the well-being of the people. And the well-being of the people cannot occur without a pullback from this overly expensive and poisonous and destructive military empire. And that's why I said that Trump represents imperial retreat. Now the question is whether or not the American people can mobilize themselves to then say, with the retreat, we want a drastic cut in the military budget.
Right.
We want a real detente with Russia. We want a pullback, but an investment in building the infrastructure of this country. So, I mean,
Yep. I'm looking at this piece in Truthdig. Could Trump take down the American empire? This is Gareth Porter's piece. There's one little narrative in the middle of it that really gets to the core, and I think the value of citing it is that he's actually cribbing from Woodward's book. So this isn't Gareth Porter narrating, but rather Robert Woodward. And it's about a meeting that Mathis, Tillerson, and others had in July of 2017.
I think you're talking about Mattis.
Mattis. And at the meeting, Mattis is talking in neoliberal, neocon terms, really,
right,
about the empire, the globalism, the rules-based international democratic order had brought prosperity and security. And Tillerson says this is what's kept the peace for 70 years. So it says Trump said nothing, according to Woodward's account, but simply shook his head in disagreement and eventually steered the discussion to an issue he was particularly interested in, South Korea. He said, we spend $3.5 billion a year to have troops in South Korea. I don't know why they're there. Let's bring them all home. At that point, Reince Priebus, who was Trump's chief of staff at the time, he's the guy that was before that the head of the RNC. He's, one of the institutional boys. Mm-hmm. Recognizing that this team's effort to get control of Trump was a failure, called a halt to the meeting. And that the following month, even as Trump was threatening in tweets to destroy, now to me this just tells the picture for people who need to understand this, as he threatened in tweets to destroy North Korea, he was privately hammering aides over the U.S. troop presence in South Korea and repeatedly expressing a determination to remove them. This is according to Bob Woodward. So, what more do you have to say about that? All these people, when you try to tell them, look, maybe there's some advantages here for the peace movement, let's work this, they look at you like you're from Mars.
Right, right. Well, because they don't proceed from empirical evidence, they proceed from already existing biases, prejudices, and assumptions. They don't like the aesthetics of the Trump White House or the Trump presidency. Right. So they're going They make judgments based upon their sense of what the president should act like or what he should say. The fact of the matter is that also Woodward quotes from one of those meetings, which Trump said, we've spent $6 trillion on these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. And he said, I can't even get $1 trillion to rebuild the infrastructure of this country. Woodward quotes from that meeting, or a leak from that meeting, that Trump said, look, why don't we just pull out of Afghanistan and declare victory? We can't win there. He is talking about, and I say it over and over again, imperial retreat, which in this context makes him a peace president,
right,
more than any since John F. Kennedy.
Right. And hopefully with a different outcome. And, you know,
yes,
I mean, when you're talking
absolutely.
About the aesthetics, you know, let's use the language of Marx, Engels, Lenin, etc. You know, we're talking about, or even Hegel. Mm-hmm. We're talking about appearance versus essence. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
you know, if you're going to talk, I guess the word today for aesthetics is optics. And but what it is illusion. That's essentially mm-hmm. what it is, as opposed to what really is going on. And we are supposed to confront the world that is, not the one we
yes.
like. If this one
yes.
is ugly, too bad. You can't ask them for the pretty one and then mm-hmm. have to engage the ugly, because the ugly is what's there, and that's what you have to deal with. And
absolutely.
If you want to deal with it, then you got to deal with it as it is.
And you know, Don, and we want to know the world. We want to understand the world in order to change it.
Right.
If you do not understand it,
right.
then you can always be angry and enraged. I mean, and in this environment, that's part of what politics is. But we who have a different responsibility to humanity must understand what's going on in order to change what is to something better. When Gareth Porter talks about Trump taking a wrecking ball to the principal institutions of American imperialism, starting with the media, the propaganda arm of the financial oligarchs, this is profoundly important, profoundly significant, you know, and that's what we have to look at.
Yep.
I am appalled, frankly, but I guess I should not be surprised at how gullible the what goes for the American left is. In this situation, how easily they follow the ideological lead of the corporate media, which is, of course, a combination of the deep state and Wall Street imperial interests. I mean, how gullible they are. I mean, and again, you know, the labor movement has been very, very pragmatic with regards to Trump, especially on the trade deals, especially the industrial unions.
Right.
The pullback from TPP was not a bad thing.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
So.
And growth in the steel industry, which is real.
Yeah.
You know, it's real. That actually is a real thing. And there are other areas.
But
in
that
the real
growth
economy.
Cannot be sustained
right.
unless there is trillions of dollars, not $1 trillion, but multiple trillions of dollars invested
That's
in
correct.
Infrastructure.
Right.
We need a New Deal kind of economic policy on steroids.
Right, right. Without
you know?
The incentive
and,
of World War
and
II.
And here, here's
right.
where I criticize Trump's monetarist almost supply-side economic policies. Mm-hmm. You see, and here Christine Lagarde of the IMF is absolutely right about this. Tax cuts of the magnitude that the Republicans and Trump passed may give the economy a quick fix, but it is not sustainable because it increases the federal debt. I mean, it's a risk. I feel that in economic policy, Trump is throwing Hail Mary passes. And maybe that's the best he can do in the political environment,
yeah,
where the Republicans control both houses and the Democrats don't have a serious economic policy. 10 years of economic stagnation, 10 years of no rise of wages,
right,
for working people,
right,
10 years of people dropping out of the labor force. How do you reverse that? Not with tax cuts. The only way is massive government spending to employ people and put money in the pockets of the working class and lower middle classes. That's the only answer. History proves that. Keynes was right. Milton Friedman is wrong. What else can you say? And you know, you read the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal as I do, and we might be heading in to another financial collapse. The only difference between this one, I think, that's coming up and the one of 2008, this one will begin a sovereign debt crisis in the emerging markets like Argentina and Turkey and other places, whereas the 2007-2008 one began as a financial crisis beginning in the advanced capitalist countries.
Tony, thank you so much for your time and and your insight. And let me know if the royalty checks start coming in.
Yeah, I shall, man. You'll be the first to know.
Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Hillary Clinton says civility can only return when the Democrats are back in power. Former Obama AG Eric Holder has coined a new phrase: when they go low, we kick them. Without a doubt, both statements can be dismissed as political banter as the midterms loom. But it would seem no one can claim much virtue and civility in this environment. Crosstalking political discourse, I'm joined by my guests in Washington, Richard Goodstein. He is a Democratic political strategist and a former advisor to Hillary Clinton's two presidential campaigns. We also have Christopher Barron. He is president of Right Turn Strategies. And we have Rena Shah. She is a Republican strategist and a principal at Relax Strategies. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Richard, you know I'm going to go to you first. Okay, Richard, Hillary Clinton's, wandered out of the woods and had an interview and talked about civility, which was pretty hard for me to swallow. And then a former attorney general kicked them. I mean, I can understand why people accuse Donald Trump of pulling down the discourse, and that would be fair, okay? But should these two other figures be doing this as well? Go ahead, Richard.
As a point of reference, Donald Trump said to his supporters, if you see a protester, punch him, and I'll pay your legal fees. So that's just kind of a baseline. Okay,
okay, I already gave you that. I already gave you that. Okay, but why is Holder and Hillary Clinton doing it? Go ahead.
Yeah, I would urge your viewers, Peter, to watch the entire interview. People like you who support Donald Trump and others are taking that one sentence out of context.
I don't support Donald Trump. Well, I don't.
Well, then listen to the whole interview. She said, we want to be civil. But what she's saying is, when we're being dealt with in a way that's uncivil, when the rules are being broken, you know, Bill Clinton famously said, it's better to be strong and wrong versus weak and right. And I think what she was saying is, we Democrats have been weak and right, and we can't do that anymore. That's what she's talking about. This notion that she's suggesting that people be uncivil, again, is wildly out of context. Please, I tell your viewers, watch
that's
the
not
full
out
interview
of context.
With
Chris
Chan,
I'm poor. By the way, Peter, that is...
Okay, the Democrats Peter, are nice, warm, fuzzy
spin.
Things. Really? Really? Nice, warm, fuzzy things? And now they're going to play tough? Go ahead, Christopher.
I was going to say, like, first off, it is hilarious for us to pretend that Democrats have always been so civil. Look, it was Hillary Clinton who took the unprecedented step of actually running not just against Donald Trump, but against running against the people who supported Donald Trump. Never before have we had a major presidential candidate campaigning against voters, not against her opponent, not against his policy,
and she won by
but against voters.
She won
it was
by
completely unprecedented.
Votes.
And she's not president. I know you guys are so upset about the rules, but every time we win, you guys want to change the rules. Here's what I would recommend you do. I would recommend that you guys not try to out-Trump Trump. Because you're never going to be able to do it. If you really want to have a discussion about the policy, that's fine.
Just like the questions I sent out through my producers, this asymmetrical thing. This is what Donald Trump does, and the Democrats don't understand, can't comprehend it, and don't know how to fight back against it. Okay. It's also back to Arena in Washington here. I mean, if you want to talk about civility, I'd like to know what Brett Kavanaugh's opinion about what civility is in Washington today. Go ahead.
Well, I'll just start by injecting my own opinion is that civility really is dead here in 2018 in the United States. As I've traveled the country since 2016, I've just found pockets where people seem to be more than just angry. They literally feel like they've been wronged and something needs to be done about it. And I see that on both sides. I'm a centrist at heart. And what I saw with these Kavanaugh hearings and essentially the confirmation was just all that coming to the surface again, a very visceral response from both sides and people just not willing to see the gray area here. This was tough for two people, Dr. Christine Blasey Ford and Judge Kavanaugh. Undeniably, Judge Kavanaugh won out. He is now a justice on the highest court in our land, and he was able to prevail. But, you know, Republicans aren't willing to leave it alone. They're sort of saying, you sullied the good name of a man who worked his whole life for this. Democrats are stomping mad, feeling like, you know, this is just the worst thing that could happen in our lifetimes. I'm sitting here saying that when are we Americans going to start acting like Americans again and seeing each other for who we are, at our differences, but understanding that there's more that unites us than divides us?
I'm going to save time and not ask a question. Well, Go ahead, Richard.
I'm not sure if this is the single worst thing that's happened in our political lifetime, but it makes people gag when the president says at his swearing-in mock ceremony, he was proven innocent. That's a lie. It makes people gag to have him say to a rally, making fun of this woman who years ago told her therapist about this incident and told her husband and told others. It makes people gag that a president of the United States who already mocked a handicapped reporter, mocked John McCain for getting shot down by the North Vietnamese, mocked this woman because when she was 15, she couldn't remember who drove her there. She remembered the bed. She remembered having a hand over her face. She remembered the music being turned up. She remembered the laughing at her. She remembered having to run out of the house. She remembered all that. And Donald Trump, the President of the United States, mocks her. That is nauseating.
By the way, Christopher, hang on here. You know, it wasn't a he said, she said. It was she said, and they did not corroborate
Okay.
Fine.
There was only one other person in the room. Said was a lifelong
you guys,
drunk.
Okay, I know the Democrats want blood revenge, okay? We'll see the midterms. Christopher, go ahead.
But if you want to talk about a victim of sexual assault who had corroboration at the time, contemporaneously, who told people, it's Juanita Broderick, who I spent a week with during the Kavanaugh hearings, who was viciously raped by President Bill Clinton. And by the way, we still have Democrats out there today defending Bill Clinton. So I don't want to hear anything about what Dr. Ford went through. I don't want to hear anything about the way that President Trump talked about...
You,
Look, I'm telling you right now, it is a disgrace what was done and what is continued to be done by Juanita Broderick.
Okay, Rena, let me go back to you. I think
when she was under oath, when she was under oath, she denied it, Christopher. Go check the record. When Juanita Broderick was put under oath,
I know exactly. By the way, I know exactly why. I know. You want to know why?
Because I don't want to.
The very first time she.
I don't. You know, we're gonna hear about the Clintons after the election on their tour. Okay, let's save it for then. Okay, Rena in Washington also.
Fair enough.
You know, one of the things, and being a centrist, because I appreciate that. It seems to me when I look at the Democratic Party's friendly media, CNN, MSNBC, Washington Post, New York Times, I mean, do you think that it's in their favor to just continue this anti-Trump rage? Because that's all it is, okay? And I think that you've already made your mind up about Donald Trump. I mean, who in the world hasn't by now, okay? It seems to me it's counterproductive. I can't even watch those two channels because they say the same thing 24/7. I already heard it from them 2 years ago. Go ahead, Rena.
Yeah, you know, so this is where we're at. It goes to my earlier point of us just not being able to listen to the other side. I was born and raised in southern West Virginia, which is Trump country. How many rallies has the president done out there? I go back every few weekends, and my family enjoyed great prosperity in the southern part of the state, and we still very much love that part. It doesn't matter to me that people say to me that Donald Trump is the next, you know, he's sort of like a demigod around there. Let's just admit it. And I couldn't be further from supporting this president. But look, the thing to me is I understand that these people felt depressed. They felt like Donald Trump offered them something. Yeah. He offered them solutions to their woes. Now, that remains yet to be seen. Right now, in this moment, the economy is doing great. We know this may not last forever. But people in my home state of West Virginia felt like they wanted something else than Clintonian policies. And they just didn't feel that Hillary Clinton, like I did, really could relate to the plight of the average American woman because she'd been out of touch with it for a while. Now, the great irony there is that Donald Trump with his gilded commodes in Trump Tower, you know, look, like he was a guy, if you ask me, couldn't really relate to the average West Virginian either. But we have to understand all points. We have to take all points. And that's what America is at its core, is when we listen to each other and come together to craft solutions. When I was on Capitol Hill as an aide, things only get done when you work with the other side. In this moment, I was so disappointed to see Democrats on the Judiciary Committee acting the way they did during the Kavanaugh hearings, because it was pure theater. And this is what we're doing. We're doing a disservice to American people when we get on platforms and just talk about, really, again, the ugly side of things. Let's talk about what we can agree on. The economy is doing fine right now, and I'm happy for that.
It's very, you know, Richard, it's really interesting. Apparently, over at CNN and MSNBC, you can't use the word mob right now, referring to a lot of the protests, violent protests that we've seen over the last few weeks here. But that's the difference between the two Americas right now. It's in the eye of beholder. Some people say it's a protest. Other people say it's a mob. Getting back to what Rena said, how do we bridge that gap? Because I look at Fox's coverage of it, and it certainly looks like a mob to me. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah. So, again, Donald Trump is in Fox are using this mob notion because they always need an other. It's MS-13. It would be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez if Donald Trump could pronounce her name. So it's Maxine Waters. It's Hillary Clinton. They talk about locking her up. So many of these people around Donald Trump and his campaign are going to jail. So they talk about the mob because they need an other, something to scare people with. Well, the mob they have to worry about are the mobs of Democrats who went to the polls during the primaries and who look like they're going to be coming out in the general election. That's the mob that I think Trump and Fox need to worry about.
Yeah, but, you know, let me go to Christopher before we go to the break here. But that's what they said about the Tea Party, didn't they?
Right, exactly.
And,
it was
and,
so amazing.
And Barack Obama lost 63 seats.
When you saw the Tea Party gathering and being upset about the policies of Barack Obama and what was happening in Washington, we heard about how awful the Tea Party was and how it was a mob. And now we have actual mobs out there banging on the doors of the Supreme Court, throwing things at people, attacking people. We're seeing violence, and we're not supposed to call it a mob. It's pure gaslighting. Be honest about what it is. It's ugly. It's absolutely ugly.
All right,
and you shouldn't be trying to
jump in here
to it, and you turn Titus.
I gotta go to a hard break here. After our short break, we'll continue our discussion on whether the mob rules. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World
on CPR.
Let's go back to Rena in Washington. One of the things that's come out from this whole Kavanaugh spectacle, I would call it, because it was pure theater, and it was really quite disgusting. And I think, you know, I can agree for a variety of reasons why it was disgusting. I'm fair about that there. But, you know, how are the American people supposed to accept this? Because it seems like it's, you know, not just chaos on one side, but the entire political process is here. I know Richard, for example, has been very critical of the Electoral College. That's a fair point. But it's part of our system. That's what we have right now. Can't we have a normal conversation and say, well, I was kind of made 200 years ago and the country was very different. And maybe we should update our institutions here. I'm not saying it should be done, because if it weren't, then you'd just have these archipelagos, blue archipelagos on the West Coast and the East Coast, and they'd run the country. That's not the whole country. But I'm open to a discussion. But we don't hear that. Go ahead.
Well, the middle of the country is why I think we have Donald Trump entirely, is because there were mistakes made by the Clinton campaign in sort of discarding those states, the flyover states, right? And when you discard and dismiss exactly some of America, you just don't understand. You don't understand what it's going to take to really bridge us and bring us together. So what I'm going to say about this is that, yeah, this moment is tough for all of us. I think, especially as a woman in 2018, I was a very young girl during Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, but I thought we were better than that. I thought we were better than talking about this stuff in a public forum and having people really just lay into people for what they're feeling, because we talk about feelings a lot and being careful about, you know, respecting each other's feelings in a modern democracy. What we saw was just completely disgusting on both sides. I had mentioned what I saw from Democrats performing what I thought was just art in motion. But look, Republicans were also at fault. Lindsey Graham, the tone he took. And for me, I supported Judge Kavanaugh until I saw him appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee after Dr. Ford. I questioned his temperament when he said what goes around comes around. That really scared me. No justice, at least the one that wants to sit on the highest court in the land, shouldn't talk like that.
That's what's so fascinating about this, because I thought Kavanaugh's presentation was spot on. Some of the greatest public speaking in my lifetime. A man defending his good name. I thought it was remarkable. Let me go to Richard here. Richard, a lot of people... I don't want to talk about the Kavanaugh thing, the whole thing, because I have a real question for you, and I think a good one, okay? I mean, you've been on this program critical of the Electoral College. We have some Democrats, leading Democrats, questioning the legitimacy of the Supreme Court right now. A lot of people on the conservative side would say, this is what you liberals do. You want to break down and destroy institutions you can't control. Okay? How do you react to that?
So the last two Republican presidents, both of whom got fewer votes, in Donald Trump's case, way fewer votes than their competitors, are responsible for 4 of the 9 justices on the Supreme Court. Did they win the Electoral College? They did. I will stipulate that. Is it fair to say the American public voted for Donald Trump to do X? No, because most people voted either for Hillary Clinton or Jill Stein, who was even more liberal, or a lot of them voted for Gary Johnson, who agreed with Clinton Stein. So I would say way more than half of the people voted for policies quite the opposite of Donald Trump. So it is, you know, are we going to amend, you know, have a constitutional amendment to change the Electoral College? No. Why? Because right now, 17% of the U.S. public represented in the Senate by these small states can basically get judges confirmed. They make up 51 of the senators, okay? But you also need them to get a change in the Electoral College. That's just not going to happen. So Democrats aren't braying at the moon to change the Electoral College. They would like to see more people votes counting as opposed to fewer. But the reality is what it is. Did Hillary ignore certain states and miss kind of a campaign? Of course, she made mistakes. Did the Russians and Comey, voter suppression, all that help? No, that didn't help her either.
Okay. All right. We're still waiting for that big report. Okay. Anyway, Christopher, again, I mean, Richard comes on this program very often, and I consider him a friend, okay? So I'm not dismissive of him. But, you know, again, you know, It's like the liberals moving the goalposts all the time here. Okay, I don't care. It's immaterial who won the popular vote because we have the Electoral College. It doesn't matter, okay? That's the rule. 270, right. You win, okay? Nothing else matters here. So again, you know, this perception, if you don't like the institution, how it works, and it doesn't work for you because you want power, you're dismissive of it, or you want to change it or get rid of it. Go ahead, Christopher.
Right. Well, and by the way, that's what we've seen from Democrats. And first off, Donald Trump won 7 of the 10 largest states in the country. So this idea that he only won because of West Virginia and Kansas is ridiculous. Secondly, we've heard them say that the Electoral College is flawed. We need to do away with the Electoral College. It's not fair. It's not fair how the Senate works. We should have more proportional representation. It's not fair the way the Supreme Court is currently, you know, compromised. We need to stack the court, you know, expand it to 11 or 13 justices. At the end of the day, Democrats should try winning by the rules that we have in place now. And if they can't, they should admit that the reason they want to change those rules is because they can't win by the rules that we've all agreed to play by for the last couple of hundred years. It's simply absolutely ridiculous to me to hear the Democrats come up with excuse after excuse after excuse after excuse about how fundamentally the problem isn't them or their candidates. The problem is our institutions. I think that is fundamentally wrong.
Rena, recent polls
have shown. Let's talk
ahead,
about something.
Go ahead. Yeah. That's the point of the program. Jump in. Go ahead.
You know, I just have something constructive to talk about. And I certainly don't mean to sound ageist or at all sexist, but I mean, there is a problem with women being represented in our federal government, especially when we are comprising more than half of the U.S. population. So I've been working on a lot of things to get just more women on across the political spectrum involved in U.S. politics at all levels, because I think more women will lead to a stronger democracy. But something constructive we could do, when I was sitting here watching all this in the U.S. Senate, and I just thought to myself, we need term limits. I mean, a lot of these people are so out of touch and just not with it. They don't, either they're not using technology the way that most Americans do. They've been comfy in their jobs for a very long time. So a lot of they're not willing to take risks. A lot of the decisions make are rooted in can I come back or not?
But to be fair,
this is a problem.
But to be fair, these people are elected. If you like them or not, people do.
Sure,
okay.
Sure.
And I think that will slowly but surely happen. On a slightly different point, I remember when Facebook was testifying in front of Congress. Most of the Congress didn't even understand how Facebook worked. And so I get your point in not being able I had 1,000 questions. Well, okay, but we're rapidly running out of time. Richard here, and going towards the midterms. It looks like the Democrats are going to just double down on everything they've done since 2016. Is that wise? Is that winnable? Go ahead.
Well, I would say every pundit, and I take myself out of that, in Washington, just look at the polls district by district. The Democrats look like they're likely to win control of the House of Representatives. Incidentally, something that would have been impossible had Hillary Clinton won, we wouldn't be talking about the Democrats flipping the House. The question would be, can the Republicans get 60 votes in the Senate? Now it looks like they may be kind of in a struggle to kind of hold their own. I think what Democrats are going to talk about is not impeaching Trump, not impeaching Kavanaugh, but about health care and whether people with pre-existing conditions will or won't get coverage. Donald Trump would have the answer be no. They're going to talk about corruption and, more importantly, a check on Donald Trump. It's not about how horrible he is and mocking handicapped people or women. It's the fact that they see him engaging in ways that they want somebody in Washington looking over his shoulder. And right now, there's not.
So
why Democrats are going to win control of the House.
Okay, Christopher, weigh in on that, because there does seem to be an indication. Again, I'm holding my breath because the polls got it all wrong in 2016, so who knows what's going to happen here. But there seems to be the Republican-based... It seems to be coming out of its slumber, okay? It's getting a little bit more energized. The Kavanaugh thing certainly energized a lot of people. For me personally, it was one of the most horrific thing, public spectacles I've ever seen in my life. I could not believe my eyes. It was so horrifically horrible in so many different ways. Christopher.
Yeah, I would say one thing. If this election were held in July, Democrats would have picked up 60 to 70 seats in the House. It would have been a complete and total wipeout. The Democrats can't get any more juice out of that lemon. Essentially, their voters were as motivated as they could possibly be. The Kavanaugh hearings were a complete and total political misplay by Democrats. I talked to campaigns all across the country. Republicans are seeing a surge in enthusiasm. They're seeing motivated Republicans, something that, by the way, not many Republican voters have been motivated by support
It's almost an oxymoron. That's almost an oxymoron. Motivated Republicans. Okay, keep going, Christopher.
Right now, yeah, absolutely. Like, yeah, I was going to say, look, Republican voters are motivated by Trump, and Trump's base is not motivated to go out and elect a whole lot of Republicans in the House and the Senate, who, quite frankly, haven't done a good job of pushing the president's America
Very
first
good
agenda.
Point.
The Kavanaugh hearings motivated and mobilized those people. I'm telling you, I'm seeing it all across the country from campaigns I'm talking to where they are getting inundated with volunteers, people who've been sitting on the sidelines, who are finally stepping up and see what is really at stake in this election. And I will tell you this much. If the Democrats win back the House in November, you can guarantee Donald Trump gets reelected in 2020. It is the absolute best thing for the president's reelection is a Speaker Pelosi.
Okay, Reno, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought about that. Go
well,
ahead.
That's what he wants.
The last minute goes to you. Last minute goes to you.
Christopher, come on. He really wants that. Donald Trump wants Democrat takeover in the House so he can blame it on a Pelosi, okay? Let's be honest. And I just want to lay it out here. Donald Trump is not a Republican. Donald J. Trump is not a Republican.
I agree.
He is for himself. And what has happened is that Americans across the country felt the energy. I remember driving in 2016 and getting nervous when I was working against the president. And again, I'm a lifelong Republican. When I saw handmade signs in southwestern Virginia, I mean, these were not signs distributed by the campaign from New York. These were signs that were painted by supporters. I mean, this was a movement. And I think now America's grappling with, like, what do we do with this guy that is shaking things up in such a way that it's scary to those of us who really care about institutions and the freedom of the press and other such things that he seems to sometimes endanger. But he's not all bad. And I don't know that we can ever get to that moment where the left can even acknowledge some good that he's done, because we're just so divided. So here we are in a moment where we're going to see what happens with the midterms. But I think the youth vote's going to come through, Peter.
We'll see at the midterms. Many thanks to my guests in Washington. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.